Judy, would you mind if I say it?
Oh, sure. What
okay,
do you
want? Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Wait till the courtroom's cleared. Did you call it?
No.
Okay. All right, Mr. O'Connor, before you began, let me just caution you that there is security-sensitive information in this case. We are in open court. The Department of Justice is concerned that based on pre-oral argument activity that you might go into SSI inadvertently, whatever. I'm just cautioning you that if you feel you're going to, you either rest on your brief or you stop, because this court is not going to let you discuss anything about SSI information, SSI in open court.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. I understand that. And based upon the editing that they did for the public filing of our brief, I'm not too concerned that there will be any discussion of
all right.
of SSI. I mean, we'll hope for the best as we go forward. I'm going to try not to.
Well, if you think you're getting close, advise the court, because we'll have to close the courtroom. We're not going to let it spill out and then try to put it back together. And that the burden's on you. So go ahead.
May it please the court, good morning. I'm Robert O'Connor. I represent Suburban Air Freight. This is an appeal of an adverse administrative agency decision imposing civil penalties on Suburban Air Freight for alleged violations of the 12-5 security program. The 12-5 security program is one of several created by Congress and the TSA post 9/11. This program is for small airplanes that carry freight. I think it's important that you realize that the program is not for all freight haulers and not for all airplanes that haul freight. It is limited to those that carry freight in excess of 12,500 pounds of gross weight. So there are many aircraft carrying freight throughout the United States that are not covered by this program. They are not regulated. It is the timing of the coverage of the 12-5 program that brings us here today. Our position is on coverage is simple. The regulation 49 CFR 1544.101D says operation of the aircraft must be carrying cargo, which is later specifically defined. And in that specific definition, they talk about an airway bill, which is then further defined. There was no airway bill for the flight Suburban Air Freight hauled for DHL from Richmond to Cincinnati. There did not need to be one. The 12-5 program did not apply. Additionally, issues are raised on this appeal with regard to the inspection duties of a middleman in the freight security process. Here, a visual inspection is all that's required. Other questions that are presented is whether or not a security inspection is any less effective because the inspector does not have a written agreement with the carrier. Two, when must pilot credentials be checked and by whom? And as a subpart of that is, what are we trying to learn or to prevent? Simply, does the program cover the conduct complained of? Suburban Air.
Let's get the framework right, okay? You don't disagree, do you, that when we look at these issues, we owe considerable amount of deference to the agency about its interpretation of its regulations and, in particular, about the TFSSP, right?
Yes.
You don't disagree with any of that?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
Okay. So to prevail, you've got to show us that the agency's interpretations of these documents, the regs and the TFSSP, are unreasonable, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not just that you disagree with it.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
So go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Suburban Air Freight is a carrier that's subject to FAA certification. It has a TSA approved security plan known as the 12-5 program, which applies to certain of its aircraft on certain flights. Suburban Air has extensive experience consisting of flying jets, turbines, and piston-powered aircraft, both single and twin engines, in all weather conditions, both on scheduled and on-demand routes for major freight forwarders, including Airborne, Burlington Air Express, DHL, UPS, the Postal Service, and the Department of the Interior. The basic misunderstanding is that TSA has based its argument on the fact that Suburban Air Freight admitted that it is subject to the 12-5 program, but fails to understand that while Suburban Air Freight has an approved program, the program does not apply to every Suburban Air Freight operation. We were a middleman for DHL. That's where the packages originated, that's where they were inspected, and that's where they were vetted by DHL and its employees. Suburban Air Freight merely acted as a carrier, a middleman, and they were not the point of entry for the freight being carried. And I think that's an important thing for the court to look at when you're considering how this all fits together, is that the program was designed to cover two instances, the first of which is where a carrier such as Suburban Air Freight would be the entry point for the freight. Someone brings freight to Suburban Air and says, carry this somewhere else for me. At that point, an air waybill would be necessary, telling us all of the essentials about what the freight was, what it cost, what its value was, who we were to deliver it to, and what other conditions were going to be imposed. The second situation is the one that was applicable here, where Suburban Air Freight was only acting as a middleman, carrying freight for DHL to another DHL location. In those instances, our duties were substantially less than they would be as if we were the principal point or the entry point of freight into the system.
What are those duties, and where are they set out?
They're set out in the 12-5 program.
In the same program that you say you're not covered by?
Well, in which instance, Your Honor? In an instance where we're carrying freight as the entry point, that we have additional responsibilities that are set forth in the program. Yes, ma'am.
No, but for this flight.
For this flight, our position is that the 12-5 program did not apply.
Because you weren't carrying cargo because there was no airway bill.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's just that simple. I realize that seems almost ludicrous to stand here and be arguing about such a thing, but very clearly, the way the statutory scheme was created, the regulations said you've got to be carrying cargo. They went on to define what cargo is. Cargo says you have to have an airway bill. Nowhere.
Well, the agency says there is an airway bill. DHL confirmed in this email.
Yeah, there's a couple of problems that are created by that, Your Honor. First of all, if you look at Exhibit 10, very clearly, it is not an airway bill. It is an all-system summary.
But you can get to the way bill by
No, you can't. It does not contain the information that is required to be contained in an airway bill on that exhibit.
As I understand it, it's a list. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and if you're interested in one.
It is indeed a list, Your Honor, but there are.
Find what the details of one are.
The details are contained in the plan, Your Honor, and the plan is contained in the 12-5 program, and we're not going to be talking about that this morning. But very clearly, the definition of airway bill is contained in the 12-5 plan, and the documents that they presented in their exhibit during the trial of this matter did not conform to that. More importantly, they were not an airway bill. Even if you're going to consider it to be an airway bill, they were not an airway bill for the day in question. The day in question was October 9th, 2009. The documents they presented were from almost a year later. So the government
says that's because you didn't raise this issue till later, and this was a master way bill.
It was not a master way bill, Your Honor, because
they found that it was.
It very clearly
was
not.
I asked you about deference.
Well,
I mean, you're arguing the case as if we're hearing this thing de novo.
No, I think there's two kinds of deference that apply to this case. The first kind of deference is the Chevron deference based upon the regulation itself, which has to be decided whether or not it is plain on its face. We believe the regulation is plain on its face. What's not clear is the plan, and the plan you have to look at then under...
What's clear on its face?
The regulation
it
itself.
It says accounted for in a waybill. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what's... What's clear about that? I know it has to be accounted for, but the agency has said this was because this was a master waybill. How's that?
Well, and that's where we claim that the agency is being arbitrary, capricious, and unfair because the document itself doesn't say air waybill on it. And even if you ignore what the document says, the content of the document does not contain the information required to be an air waybill, nor is it for the date in question of a violation.
What about Judge Rogers' point that it's a document that allows you to find all that information?
It does not. It does not contain all of the information required, nor was it presented to us at the time of...
But it's discoverable through it.
I disagree, Your Honor. It is not.
I know you do, but TSA found that it was.
That's the part that's unreasonable. The part that's unreasonable is when the administrative law judge says he doesn't understand why we're making such a big deal about cargo and air waybill, when cargo and air waybill are clearly defined in the statute and the regulation, and we're saying you got to have those things in order for the regulation to apply to this particular flight. If that were going to apply, then DHL should have been required to be providing us with an air waybill at each time we took a flight for them.
Okay, I want to be clear. Judge Tatel asked you in the beginning whether you thought deference was due, both as to the agency's interpretation of the regulation and what he called the FSSSP, which I'll call the security plan. And what I understand you to be saying now is two different analyses are due. That while we would defer to the agency's reasonable interpretation of its regulations, since the security plan is something that your client signed as well as the agency, a different kind of deference is due, or no deference is due.
Now, I'm sorry if I have been unclear with regard to that, Judge Rogers, and I apologize. What I am trying to say is that the Code of Federal Regulations is entitled to deference as it stands. The plan itself, the 12-5 plan, the security plan, is subject to interpretation. It is subject to question by this court since it...
Under what standard? That's all I'm trying to...
The Seminole Rock, our...
Well, our is, deference to the agency's reasonable interpretation of its regulations.
And this is, and our position is, if you look at the regulation, look at their interpretation, it's unreasonable.
Well, but isn't the plan sort of like a tariff, which gets deep deference from this court? Right? We rarely second guess an agency's interpretation of a tariff, right? And isn't that what this thing looks like? It's, right?
I'm sorry?
I asked you a question.
I didn't hear the question part.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was saying that I was just pursuing Judge Rogers' question about deference to the plan. The plan seems to me to be analogous to a tariff.
Luckily, Your Honor, I know nothing about tariffs.
Well, for purposes of my question, you should know that we give great deference to agency interpretations of tariffs, even more than to regulations.
Judge, I presume you give great deference to every federal regulation until someone raises a question about it. I don't doubt that at all. They're entitled to deference. They're the administrative agency charged with enforcement of a specific area of congressional inquiry.
So where
I'm fine
it
with
says
that.
Accounted for
yes.
by an air waybill.
Right.
And the agency says, in its judgment, it's sufficient that DHL has this master list, and the master list has the numbers on it that will advise or enable you to access or obtain the original air waybill. Well, as I understand part of your point, and I didn't get this from your brief, candidly, but that may just be me, is that you're saying the way the agency is interpreting this is strictly in the first set of circumstances, namely that all of these security provisions that are in the plan apply by their terms to the first situation you identified where your client is the entry point of whatever it's going to carry?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And you're saying when you're a middleman, then the agency ought to treat your client just the way the agency treats airline passengers.
Exactly.
That once you get on a flight, if you have to change planes before your ultimate destination, you don't have to go through security again. And the agency's rejected that.
Yes, they have.
And so why is that unreasonable when they say redundancy is, you know, their motto?
Well, for a couple of reasons. Because in the documents that they submitted in Exhibit 10, DHL tells TSA that they don't give us anything other than a certificate of tender, and that it has this multi-level all product inquiry report. And if you look at the categories of the multi-level all product inquiry report, it does not contain the regulatory information of an airway bill. Therefore, it cannot be an airway bill. I see that I've used up the first part of my time. Unless you have any other questions, I'll come back. Thank you.
Ms. Swingle?
Thank you, Your Honor. Sharon Swingle for the Department of, or for the Secretary of TSA. Just to start with this question about the airway bill, I think we do give deference to the administrator's final decision, and I think that decision was amply supported by evidence in the record. The agency submitted testimony of two inspectors that they had confirmed with DHL that the cargo in question was accounted for on a way bill. As you see, we submitted a sample certificate of tender from DHL, which showed for a different date what is kind of accounted for, and it is a comprehensive listing of the individual waybill numbers. That information then allows someone in Suburban Air's position to go and identify on DHL's system all of the specific information that one looks for in the airway bill. And I think I just...
It was a specimen.
It was, Your Honor. It was not from the specific date in question.
Was there any discovery or any explanation for why the one that fit this date was not introduced? Or?
There was not, Your Honor. It's not in the record.
Okay.
I think, really, to be clear, Suburban Air's argument in the administrative proceedings was much more focused on a different aspect, not that this was somehow inadequate to show that that was in fact the kind of information given to Suburban at the time, but that either the formal denomination of the document by DHL could take it out of the realm of an airway bill, or that that information all had to be physically provided to Suburban Air at the time. And obviously the agency's interpretation of both the regulations, which is of course entitled to deference under our end of the security program, is that it was enough for cargo to be accounted for on an airway bill, but that there was no requirement that such a way bill ever be given to Suburban Air.
So the hypothetical is there's a package that the airway bill tells you do not put in temperatures higher than 60 degrees.
Right.
And so DHL knows that. But how does Suburban, as the middleman, get to know that?
Well, Suburban,
without having the air bill,
it has access to the way bill. Certainly, it doesn't physically receive it with the package. That's correct.
So you're saying that the middle Suburban has the obligation to go look at the original airway bill?
It may, Your Honor. I'm not aware of precisely what the arrangements are, and there's nothing in the record about how DHL communicates to Suburban what handling requirements there may be for a
particular but the administrator
package.
Said it was sufficient that DHL accounts for every shipment tendered to Suburban.
Because the waybill is produced at the first step, just as a functional matter, I want to be clear. I think there is testimony in the administrative record here from some of Suburban's witnesses that also carried cargo as 12-5 operators for the major cargo freight companies, DHL, FedEx, UPS, that 90% of the time they do not physically receive an airway bill. I think it would be quite anomalous.
Because they are middlemen?
Because they are middlemen, and yet 12-5 operators.
Why doesn't the analogy to passengers apply?
Because, Your Honor, I think the very nature of the 12-5 program is to cover operations that are frequently middleman operations to ensure that you don't have a security gap in the midst
of. But there are lots of flights where passengers get off the plane and go on to another plane and they don't go back through security.
But they do so only within a secure and screened setting within the airport that is subject to its own very careful security requirements. Here, I think what Suburban's argument would mean is that the middleman in some contiguous air transportation scheme would have no security requirements, and that seems quite anomalous.
I think that's their argument.
Well,
their argument is that DHL has these heightened security requirements, and DHL has checked. And now the administrator is saying Suburban has to check.
Well, under their construction, since they're not carrying cargo, as they understand it, they have no requirements to safeguard the security of the cargo while it's in their possession, even if it might be going on to another link in the air transportation network. So I do think it would really eviscerate what is intended to be an overlapping program where you have requirements at every stage that ensure the proper custody and control of that cargo.
But you see my hypothetical? It says this package should not be placed in an environment over 60 degrees or it'll explode.
I do, Your Honor.
You know, how does Suburban ever know that?
And, Your Honor, I think that issue just was not present here, and so I don't understand as a logistical matter how that information is passed along. I do assume that the originator, you know, has instructions that are communicated as appropriate. And certainly there are specific requirements, as your honors are aware, within the security program for handling to maintain the security of the cargo.
So the administrator's statement, quote, significantly a DHL representative testified that DHL does account for every shipment tendered to Suburban on a matter, airway bill, close quote. I know the point you make about harmless errors to no testimony, but that sentence sort of encompasses this notion that Suburban would be informed.
Right. As the court is aware, the agency submitted an exhibit which was a fairly lengthy email communication back and forth between DHL and the TSA inspectors, in which DHL confirmed that in its view, all of the cargo was properly accounted for on a waybill. Turning to the question of custody and control, which was the basis for the second finding of a violation, the agency properly found here, and I think that factual finding is not clearly erroneous, that the pilot here did not maintain custody and control of the cargo in question. It was being loaded by people who were not authorized representatives or employees of Suburban, and he did not maintain constant visual custody or supervision of that cargo.
Could I ask you, the ALJ made a finding that Suburban did have prior notice of the problem with respect to the failure to have proper pilot identification.
Yes, sir.
He didn't make any finding whether there was prior notice regarding the failure to maintain custody and control. Is that something that was included in the discussions that were going on between Suburban and the TSA inspector?
It absolutely was, Your Honor, and if I could for just a minute give you some page sites in the joint appendix that speak to that issue, JA 54 to 55, page 60, and 119 to 120, and there are additional descriptions of that in the hearing transcript that are not in the JA that we would be happy to provide to the court. What the inspectors testified is that they communicated, I think, on more than one occasion with Suburban representatives to express their concerns that by having the DHL individuals, and in fact they were not employees of DHL, they were independent contractors, by having them play the role that they were playing in Suburban's operations, that there was concern both about the identification being appropriately verified, but also about whether Suburban was adequately maintaining custody and control of the cargo because of the role that was being played by those outside individuals. So that was specifically an issue of prior discussions. I believe one of the inspectors testified that initially Suburban's representative told him that the DHL individuals were conducting the screening of the cargo, but that that was an initial discussion, and obviously Suburban's position later changed. So they did have adequate prior notice. To the extent there was anything at all ambiguous about the security program, and we don't believe there is, the security program is pretty explicit and clear about what is required of a 12-5 operator. They need to accept the cargo, they need to inspect it in a variety of ways, and then once that's done, they need to maintain custody and control. And I think in the security program, 8.1C also makes clear that in maintaining custody and control, you can only do that with your own employees or authorized representatives, not with other third parties. So any ambiguity really, I think, is eliminated by the plain terms of the security program itself.
So is it your position that we owe Chevron-type deference to the agency's, the administrator's interpretation of the security plan?
I think we would be entitled certainly to some deference, and I don't know that there's a clear explanation or a clear precedent for what type of deference there would be. Obviously, much of the plan is drawn essentially verbatim from the regulations. To the extent it is further detailed here, this is the standard security program. But ultimately, I don't think the court actually needs to decide it, because I think the plan is pretty straightforward here. And to the extent—
So what's a, I'm sorry.
I just need to be clear. We defer to the agency's reasonable interpretation of its regulations.
Right.
Do we give such deference as is due sort of under a Strickland type standard to the agency's interpretation of the security plan?
Well, I do think we would be entitled to deference, and I guess I would point to Judge Tatel's description of a tariff as perhaps an analogy.
Well, is it a tariff, though?
No, it's not, but it is a standard. This is our model security program that is adopted within the industry. To the extent there are deviations from that program, they have to be agreed to in advance by the agency, and certainly—
Well, both parties sign it, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but in the interest of maintaining and ensuring a uniform body of law about the security requirements applicable to people within this heavily regulated industry, I think it would certainly be appropriate to give the agency some deference, if only
but
to
I
ensure
uniformity. But I just want to be
uniformity.
Clear that the agency's position is that to the extent Suburban is concerned about certain of its business in rural areas where having a DHL or representative or something like that, the agency said, well, you could seek to amend the security plan.
That's right, Your Honor. We've always—
So what does that mean? Just sitting down with somebody from TSA and talking this out and getting the proper signatures?
Exactly, Your Honor. They've never sought to find an exception for circumstances in which it might be more difficult. And I do want to be clear, Richmond here is a Category 1 airport. It's a major operation. There are international carriers, and they fly there approximately 6 times a week. So this is not an infrequent occurrence. They have established business relationships there. I think the agency's view was that at least at that setting, it was of significant importance to get the appropriate security limitations in place.
What sort of options do they have at these little tiny airports? What can they do there for a single pilot plane? How can they check IDs without— they either have to have an authorized agent or two pilots, right?
Well, if I may be clear, Judge Tatel, obviously no administrative actions or enforcement actions have been taken with respect to that type of airport.
Oh, I understand that. I was just asking a question about—
And the agency—
What are their options at these little tiny airports?
I'm not sure what options there might be. Uh-huh. An amendment might be a possibility. Certainly the agency, I think, repeatedly made clear to them that they would view that situation, you know, on its own merits if an appropriate request were made. And certainly I'm not aware of enforcement action.
Your point is this is Richmond, not one of those airports, right?
I just think it's a red herring, to be frank, Your Honor. And then finally, to touch briefly, if I may, on the question of verifying identification, obviously that too was raised in the early discussions with Suburban about what the requirements of its security program were. As best we can tell from the record, their pilot had no form of identity verification by anyone, certainly not in a way that would comply with the security program, and they simply took the position that it didn't apply or could be satisfied by an individual employee in a single pilot operation, which is not consistent with the agency's view. If the court has no other questions, we would ask the court to affirm.
All right, thank you. How much time does Mr. O'Connor have? All right.
Let me address first this airway bill question that you started with Ms. Swingle. In the record, at the hearing, the TSA did have two inspectors testify, neither of whom could testify to an airway bill. The best they could do was offer this multi-line Exhibit 10 thing. We presented three witnesses, Judge Rogers, as you pointed out, who said they had never dealt with an airway bill carrying this type of freight for those type of customers. And you had asked, Judge, about why did not have the evidence for that date. I don't know. We had made the amendment making that allegation several months before the trial. They had the opportunity, I thought. But the ultimate question is one of deference, as we've been talking about. And the real question is, how would we know that? The TSA is saying we were supposed to do certain things, and the simple legal question is, how would Suburban Air Freight know they were supposed to do that? If you read the regulation and you read the program, it doesn't say what they were telling us to do. And very simply, from the very beginning, the company representative, Mr. Gallup, continuously asked the TSA, where does it say that? And that was all we were trying to find out. And we never did find that out, and instead we were violated. We'd never had access to a waybill. We would never be able to answer the question about 60 degrees. If they gave us something that required special handling, we would not know that. And the question is about proof. What did get proved, we proved that there was no airway bill in this case. We gave an example of what an airway bill was and showed that they did not produce one. The administrator was incorrect in the opinion because no DHL representative testified. At this level, the TSA would ask you to ignore that error. We think that's a significant error in the record since no one from DHL testified at the hearing. Custody and control. Their three witnesses couldn't agree on what was supposed to be done. Back to my original question, what were we supposed to do? If the three TSA representatives at the hearing could not describe what the proper method of custody and control is, their question or their statement as to what the rule is certainly doesn't have any weight or bearing. We shouldn't, if they can't tell us what the rule is, how are we supposed to follow it, and which one of their investigators are we supposed to pay attention to? With regard to single pilot, very simply, all we were saying is that the rule should apply everywhere. It's not a red herring. It's an issue that we face every day throughout the United States. As far as verifying the ID, that too is another one of those questions, not of interpretation, but of the clear language of the regulation. The regulations talk about crew. Crew's more than one person. That's all we've been trying to establish from the very beginning. Pardon?
Crew member. It says crew member.
Yes, ma'am.
It doesn't say crew. Go ahead.
With that, unless you have further questions, I thank you for your time. We would ask that the decision be reversed.
All right.
Thank you.